last questions? No, in the last page.
Is material renunciation a necessary step on this path? Or a useful step?
Useless if it is, if it becomes a substitute for the renunciation of the spirit of renunciation. But if, while the spirit of renunciation is being unveiled, that's the best way to put it, while this spirit of renunciation is unveiled and it begins to unfold, if the other thing happens, it's delightful, beautiful. As a matter of fact, that again was the orthodox argument. How can you have the spirit of renunciation if your actions and if your lifestyle and if your behavior indicate that you are clinging? But then, here again, the action is centripetal. From within, it opens up, opens out. There is a spirit of renunciation within, and you find that some things are not necessary, you don't take any notice of them, you don't want them.
But what if you're not that far along?
That is the point. No, it's not that far along or this far along. At every step. So nothing is done prematurely. And again, if that happens, you don't find these terribly long faces. You know, terribly serious. I don't know what they're serious about. Definitely the look of a person who has lost something. Not given up something, lost something. I'm not saying this, there's in the New Testament at least. When you are fasting, don't pull a long face, be cheerful. Be more cheerful than the other fellow who is eating. I am doing something which is nice, marvelous, which the whole being wants to do. Why should I be miserable at all?
And if the whole being doesn't want to do it, don't do it. It's
silly to do it.
Well, how does this fit with the idea that you would do things like we were saying yesterday that you don't want to do?
That's it, as a discipline.
As a discipline.
As a discipline, and that can happen only in relation to your guru and disciple, or something like that, a master and or a husband and wife. And that also in the embryonic stage of your development, when you are totally dependent upon the other person, to point out yourself to yourself. I don't know what vanity means. I don't know what egoism means. I don't know what ego sense means. I don't know what on all this. And is that right? Then the master comes and twists my arm and says, do you know where it hurts? That is the ego sense. And again, if at that moment I am not looking within to discover where it hurts, why does it hurt? But I react to him. Ah, this man is cruel. I thought he is a good man and a good master and so on, a good guru. Look what he does. Then I missed it. And so there again, there is the difficulty on with the master. I saw this, so I'm sure in this case, quite often. He has to discipline him without losing him. If he makes him do something which he does not like, he runs away. He's not an employee, he's not a paid servant. He's a free man, he has come for moksha. And all that this guru says is, did this and that, do that. And so if he resents this chiseling, he doesn't become a statue. He rolls down the cliff. It's gone. So the master has lost a potential statue, potential perfection. So he has to chisel him. But after applying a little bit of butter, honey, a couple of bananas stuck underneath, tuck, tuck, tuck. So that if you feel too, the chiseling is too hard, you lick the banana. That sort of thing. It's a tough job, both for both the master and the disciple. It's only in that one context that doing something which I dislike is helpful. Only if there is my master sitting in front of me and watching me, then it is meaningful. Otherwise, the spirit of renunciation must come from within, not a cosmetic stuff. And therefore, even then, the master can impose a certain aspects of renunciation upon me, yes? That's possible. If I am ready, and if I am willing, if I am eager to look within, and see where it hurts.
Have you known instances in which husbands did this to their wives to good effect?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? The sting is the tail. Since we are dealing with the spirit of self-discovery, I don't know if that spirit exists between in the husband-wife relationship.
I wouldn't think so ordinarily, no.
So it doesn't exist.
I know the theory is. Sometimes.
Yeah? Is it so? I have no idea.
Well, you mentioned husband and wife.
No. If the wife so loves the husband, she may put up with that sort of thing. Not for the sake of self.
I think it happens slightly in any relationship between any two people.
Yeah, right. You are right. Then you discover the true nature of love. Not true nature of the self, as in the case of the guru and disciple. The true nature of love. It's a joy to...
I mean, they said that love is not there to give anybody pleasure. Love is there to see how much you can take.
Right. In that way, that's possible.
Oh, yes.
In that relation, the husband-wife relationship, it's possible when the husband imposes his will upon the wife or the other way around. I think it's more the other way around. No. You won't quarrel. You won't quarrel. The other partner has a chance to sort of examine and see what love is and where it goes, it's perverted. As a matter of fact, in the case of a mother and a baby, this is nearly constant. This kind of imposed forbearance. Okay. But I think most people miss it. They don't look at it that way. Because they are looking more at the child than... this needs a sort of elongated vision. Um, like a binocular, where you sit in the middle and look at both sides. You are looking within at the same time you are looking outside. You are looking at yourself and your child at the same time. You are looking at yourself and your husband or wife at the same time. Since in most relationships, either I look out, look outside, or I look within, it becomes difficult. In the case of the Guru, of course, mostly we look within. We don't judge him, we don't examine him. We only examine ourselves. Then it becomes a bit somewhat easier, simpler.
But this long vision is necessary so that one doesn't indulge the child to his harm. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were
referring to? I'm referring to something else. The child makes me do things which I wouldn't do normally. The child, in your popular expression, tries my patience. And then you look at the child, it tries my patience. And as you are looking at the child, you are also looking at yourself and seeing, why, if I love the child, why is the patient exhausted at all? So that is it. In the case of the Guru, he doesn't exhaust my patience. He is there to do what he is doing.
Well, then you can't get along too far on this path without a guru or a teacher in the sense that you're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Which is true. Any situation in which the direct discovery of the ego sense becomes necessary, I doubt very much if it is possible for one to do it without the help of a teacher, a master, a guru, some whatever word you wish to use for it. Because otherwise, the ego is capable of turning all situations to its own advantage.
Well, how about when you talk about the constant vigilance? That isn't possible to exercise without this other thing.
It's very doubtful. Constant vigilance implies that I am taking you as my guru now. In each situation. The other person, in every situation, is the guru, becomes the guru, when there is this constant vigilance.
Meaning that you turn everything back to look at yourself and your own reactions.
Right.
Rather than
the other person, but then in that relationship. You're asking me a question, and I suddenly feel that you are my guru. How do I react to this questioning? Do I become funny? Do I want to, show off? Or do I want to be rude? Or do I want to make fun of you? Etc. All these things are there. So I am watchful. So you become my guru for the present. And so when people come and say, I've got a very silly question to ask, you are my guru now. Because if you do have a silly question to ask, you are exactly going to do the same thing that a child does to the mother. You are going to try my patience, right? Guru Maharaj, I'm ready. I'm ready.
You said there wasn't any point imposing like a discipline unless your whole being was behind it, but if we're so much controlled by the sort of habit reactions and habit-formed actions, in a sense, then how, if we wanted to change something, would you ever do that?
Yeah.
Because your whole being, this other part is obviously not going to be with
quite
it.
Quite. That problem is discussed in quite a few chapters in the Yoga Sutra. How was the habit formed? How was the other habit formed?
Through repeated
action. Repeated action? How is an action repeated? Let's say the whole process. For instance, I have a smoking habit. How was it formed? Right from childhood, you must go back. I have a smoking habit, yes? Any habit? Do you have any habit at all which you can expose?
Smoking.
Good, marvelous. Now, can you go right back to before the beginning and walk step by step into the smoking habit? First, what happened?
Oh, I guess started when I was in high school.
I was in high school, yes.
You're talking about starting, like how I got started.
No.
How I?
You're right. You are in the high school. You have not yet started smoking. Now go on, proceed. I'm not asking you to remember all that. I mean, factually. Yeah, go on.
I think it stemmed from sort of nervousness and self-conscious.
I was nervous, and I was self-conscious. Right.
So I needed something to do.
No. How did you know that the thing called cigarette existed?
Because it was all around me.
All around me. That is, I saw other people doing smoking. Right. There was nervousness, and I saw other people smoking, and I needed something to do. Right. Now, be very cautious. You didn't start repeatedly smoking, no. You didn't start with the habit, no. You picked up one cigarette, smoked. I don't know if you can remember the taste of it. Did you like it right from the beginning or?
I don't think so.
Right, yeah. Thank you. So, you didn't particularly like it at that time, but you were nervous and you saw other people smoking. You needed something, to do something. And first you smoked only one cigarette. It wasn't a repeated cigarette. Is that possible? It's logically impossible. If you put all these things into any situation, you see how the habit develops. I am self-conscious, I am nervous. I am in an ashram, I am supposed to be working day and night and heart and soul and stomach and liver for self-realization. I am nervous, I am not doing the right thing, I am self-conscious. I really don't know what to do, and I take a mala and say, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. The same procedure is applied here for cultivating another habit. And when this habit develops, that goes down. You said something very beautifully. That the hands had something to do something. I go on, take mala. That's why mala is. No, sir. No, Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya. And I have done one mala. And so a little bit of groove is cut. And I say, go on repeating this. This groove is cut. And we discussed this much earlier, the law of balance, compensation. It's not so much retribution, it's compensation. As you go on cutting this groove here, you know, like digging a trench, some amount of this stuff has to come out. And as and when this stuff comes out, it has to be thrown somewhere else. As you throw it, the other habit groove or trench is being filled. 6 months of a little conscious digging of this trench fills the other trench.
So you would consciously or deliberately do that even if it wasn't something you'd like to do?
He likes to do it, otherwise you wouldn't do it.
The mala? I mean, this is what I think Ron was asking, that you take on a discipline. Say, even though you...
Do you feel that smoking is bad? Otherwise, you would not... the question would not arise at all.
I'm talking about the mala, though. So you start...
No, you look for something else. I want to overcome that. I'm looking for a similar antidote.
So So you don't like doing the mala, but you want to get rid of the smoking.
Yeah, right. And in that, the guru may help, again. somebody might help you.
How would that help? I mean, how would the guru help in that?
Because, way? You see, I only know that I don't want this.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to substitute. I hate smoking. Not that I hate smoking. I would love not to smoke. But my hands want to hold something. My mouth wants to do something. And I'm nervous and I'm self-conscious. I don't know how to go about this. In that situation, where one doesn't know, and this is not terribly intense. If the desire to give up smoking is terribly intense, then of course the problem doesn't arise. That's obvious, isn't it? That is, the habit is stronger than the will to give it up. That is what often we mean when we say, I'm trying to give up smoking. I've even tried some other funny method which has worked in some cases. The smoking habit is strong, let's say. It's you have battle with it, and you found it's too strong, too powerful. Right. I have no strength to give that up. I have also formed a sort of habit. That is, I'm sort of looking within and examining myself. I also formed a sort of habit that just immediately wake up, I want to have a hot drink, like a cup of tea. Can I get rid of that? Is that also very strong? No, it doesn't seem to be strong. I go without it for a couple of days. Take a weak habit. You do not have only a smoking habit, which is strong. You have a number of other habits. Some strong, some stronger than the others, some weaker than the others, some fairly weak. Attack that. Get hold of that. Chew that up. You may have here, so I don't want to mention names. There was a young lady who had some problem. Chewing your fingers. How do you get rid of that? I said, forget it. That's something which you cannot deal with. Forget it. Look out and see how you close the door of your motor car. When you come out of the car, do you bang the door? She said, yes. Good. From now, merely pay attention to that. I don't want to bang the door when I get out of the car. That has also become a habit. Not so strong as your finger chewing. Finger chewing is associated with your nervousness, etc., etc. And when you are nervous, you are not yourself, you are somebody else. So get hold of that weak habit. Deal with that. You, as soon as you open the door, you are going to say, watch out. I'm going to be gentle. Blank! Ayo! No, that's not right. The next time. And even if possible, this at the same time, if you want to be fairly fast in changing this habit, even when you have banged the door shut, no, open it again, close it gently. This is how you close, yeah? Right. Remember this next time. That's how your habit is formed. And once that habit has been changed, the flame of vigilance begins to burn. And from then on, this thing is alert to watch any habit. And the smoking habit or chewing and thumb habit, is also being watched, whether you want it or not. And so the trick is to get rid of any one habit. The weaker the better. And also we are not talking karma yoga, right? We are talking about just more gossip. Because here, the overcoming of the weak habit does bloat your ego. You call it self-respect, which is luckily for you. It is certainly a form of vanity. Because you call it self-respect, you love it and you make it grow. And that self-respect sort of looks around and chews up all the other habits.
And how do you get rid of that?
It's like squeezing a balloon.
But yes, it's good. But you see, you have become very respectable and you are very...
That's another habit. I mean...
Don't go too far. Do you this one?
It's not the way to deal with it.
Till you prick that final balloon, final bubble, none of these things is going to lead you, you know, completely out of yourself. All these are do-good business. Be good is something completely different. Be good is to be God. There is no... You are very right in that. As a matter of fact, no. I mentioned earlier on that very often we confuse mere social service with karma yoga and so on. I'm very charitable, I'm this, I'm that. And when you indulge in that kind of thing, you become more and more respectable, and you become more and more acceptable, and you become more and more, you know, you're considered a very good person by others. And this goes on and on and on and on and on, that the karma yoga is left far behind. Somebody has to be there who is ready to put that bubble there, then and there, then and there. And that can only be a master or a guru or something. I don't think it is in that Mahabharata. No. I think the story occurs in the Bhagavatam. It is said that there was a a demon. Why was he a demon? Because his grandfather was a demon. No other reason. But he himself was was a very good man, very good person. And it is said that he was a great king. He had one vow. He had taken a vow. I will not refuse anything asked of me. Whatever someone comes to me and asks, I'll give. That is the vow. And so he was doing charity and charity and charity. They said of a man called Lord Nuffield, that's the name ring a bell to you? Yeah. They said the same thing of him. And he went on giving all that he had, and still he was a multimillionaire. How that happened, nobody could figure out. So, that was the same thing with this man called Bali. King Bali. But yet, he was arrogant and vain. So that all the charity only bloated his vanity. And it is said that Vishnu wanted to quell his pride How to do it? He took form of a short little Brahmin boy, dwarf, and went to this Bali, who was performing a religious ceremony. And Bali welcomed him and said, hello young man, how, what do you want? And this young boy said, not very much, just about a little piece of ground, which I can measure with 3 paces, just 3 paces, with my own foot. And this great philanthropist laughed aloud and said, silly, can't you ask us anything more worthy? And the reason given was even more interesting. It says, no one comes to me and begs again. If you come to me, I'll give you enough for your whole lifetime. After receiving a gift from me, for you to go and ask another something else from somebody else is an insult to me. So ask unto me. He said, no, I want just that.